published by Chatto and Windus. Okay, quote, when visiting the University of Toronto, when visiting U of T in the spring of 1973, Empson and Fry Wimsett and myself had dinner. It was then that Empson told of the days when he had begun supervision, I guess it would be when he had begun supervision under I.A. Richards. Empson said that he was in the habit of regaling his undergrad friends after each supervision with a detailed account of what he and they regarded as Richards, I.A. Richards' utter absurdity. They would literally roll in the grass, howling with merriment as the crazy psychological and linguistic ideas were reviewed. Empson said it was more than a year before he began to detect some sense in I.A. Richards. Empson spent the year 1973 as visiting professor at York. Now, what's interesting is that McLuhan would be aware that many people rolled on the grass howling at Marshall's perceived ideas in the 60s.
Yeah, George Thompson that we had on our sessions was a testament to that fact, where he was going down to the pub and correcting, or at least trying to explain McLuhan to his students.
Yeah, you got to get a better position on the mic. Anyways, he says, Empson spent the year 1973 as visiting professor at York. Corinne and being completely ignored. Okay, maybe it's a missing sentence. Empson spent the year 1973 as visiting professor at York and completely ignored by the University of Toronto. Quoting McLuhan, I had him to dinner with Claude Bissell and then came an invitation to lecture at U of T. He gave an unforgettable lecture on, quote, the secret marriage of Andrew Marvell. Marvell was a political double agent for England and Holland, etc., and a hater of women. His secret marriage was motivated in part by tax problems, partly by his getting married to his landlady. The political complications exceeded all varieties of ambiguity. Empson is very noticeably deaf and has a big white mustache and the florid face of a Colonel Blimp. Typically, Wimsatt and Fry played coy at dinner, and after having nothing to say on, Now, this is proving my point. He says they were awed by Empson, like rustics. They're rustics because they're book people. And they're still living in the little book subculture. McLuhan is looking from the vast horizons and platforms of the tragic winds, to quote Wyndham Lewis, the tragic winds of the new electric environment, the electric wind. And he's looking at these little Lilliputians engaged in a Gutenberg level. And note, they have nothing to say on any subject. McLuhan knows that he can say anything on any subject with his formula and offer instant patterns. That's my point. He knew that was more important than just sitting there listening to some guy talk about his life at in England. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, hoping that my position is okay relative to the mic. It's quite interesting that McLuhan to Ezra Pound, 22nd of June 1951, where he's moaning about teachers, the thing that I think really strikes that McLuhan is annoyed with is that he says, nowadays there's no conversation at all. Teachers distrust talk as much as the businessmen. It's a mirror in which they too readily see their own vacuous plight, so they won't have it. The first element is mud. As for the fifth, it is space. And so, in a sense, okay, so we've been talking about changes, but there's also an element of continuity and sameness. So from 1951 to 1973, McLuhan's preserved that same belief in the value of conversation.
Yeah, and he's totally in tune with the 70s when the talk shows take over. Conversation is the only role for the ear in a tactile culture, especially an increasingly simulated Android meme culture. He lived in silence and worked on what he would say, because the speech, he says, that understanding media, in a note to understanding media I saw in the archives, the understanding media treats speech as archetypal. I think we got a new dimension of this, that it became a super archetypal in the 70s. He just had, the point is, he knew what to have speech about. He talked about the fads, that which were instant environments for 6 months.
Yeah, like, no, I hear you. It's I just have to say, what the hell do you mean by super archetypal, Bob?
Something past that. Well, how about this? The Android meme is taking over conversation. The Android meme is providing environments of speech. Therefore, it's squaring what Marshall saw in 64. It's squaring the fact that speech is archetypal. In the last gasps of the analog media, speech is archetypal, and McLuhan acted that out and provided speech as an anti-farmer. But in the 70s, speech as an archetypal environment is being done by the Android meme. So that requires a different kind of speech when you speak. So McLuhan was really, in the 70s, being a soundbite person. That was the anti-environment, conscious soundbiting.
Yeah, that would require probing. That's quite neat. I think there's so that we should go back over that at some point.
Yeah, it's he writes in 51 in that letter you're reading, quoting, words are a drug in the 1950s. Whereas back in the 20s, the Vortices updated, or in the teens, updated language. It was important to refine the dialect of the tribe and logocentric speech and written media. You had to update the speaking abilities of the audience. But that is not an issue when speech is a drug by 1950. So that's what, if it's a drug, then it is certainly an archetypal medium when he does Understanding Media, which Understanding Media retrieves speech as the content of the book, but it's speech in the mosaic form of grabbing for patterns, miming the TV environment. Now look at this. He says in a lecture in York University, I've cited this before, I saw it. I went up to TV Ontario, they had it. And some student is hearing the pattern of, well, movies are the content for TV, books are the content of movies, that basic first string of sequence. And this kid makes a pattern out of it as if, okay, now we're the content of the global theater, you know, something like that. And Marshall says, oh, that's happened 100 times over. He understood the replay of anthropomorphic human beings in the Android meme, which was replaying that process itself. Did you get the point there? Is that the process of going through the archetypal phases of media had been turned over many times, and that's a way of saying the Android meme was now replaying that process as it created its own machinic patterns.
Yeah, there's a point that I've always wanted to talk through at some point was that pertains to the work of Samuel Beckett, who followed after James Joyce. And there's that sense of, well, we're replaying that now, that shift from the hyper-refined verbosity that moves into a simplified, blunt way of speaking that we seem to be replaying now, that's replayed in that cycle, and that is in some way associated with these processual developments that we're talking about now.
Yeah, he writes about that, Beckett and Ionesco, in The Way You're Talking, in Cliched Archetype. Now, Bruce Powell writes an article on McLuhan in the early 80s, citing some of the interesting, very important patterns that Marshall told him in casual conversation between classes. And one of them is that Marshall said that Beckett was almost evil in his silly way of dealing with speech in his plays. He put down Beckett. See, it's why would he do that? It's because he knows that these guys don't recognize the simulation of speech. Beckett is obsolete by the 60s. And so Marshall knew he was writing the new kind of play. Marshall had moved into Web 2.0. He says to me through the Evergreens, yes, he'd create a website, but he'd use Joyce to describe how to find it. In other words, he'd hide. And Morris McLuhan told me in 71, when just he was running the front desk before George Thompson, he said, we've decided to retreat and we're not engaging the media anymore. McLuhan wasn't broadcasting to the whole world like he was in the 60s. He was moving to a whole new level of casual encounter with anything that showed up, including student newspapers. He presents astounding interviews since he wasn't getting major media coverage in little student newspapers. You know, some guy would walk in and interview him, and you see all the latest developments, and it would be in a micro environment.
Yeah, the gap is where the action is.
Yeah, and going local in a way. I'm not remembering, there's something else about what Maurice McLuhan, it's like they decided, he said something, we're going to operate locally now. Holyopathic. There's no global village to instruct anymore. So that's something to keep in mind. I think we're actually discovering a new way of talking about McLuhan right now, the 70s McLuhan.
Yeah, well, I mean, so much of McLuhan is, discussion of McLuhan is orientated around this global village or, you know, if you're an advanced critic, global theater, but that word global and the spherical nature of acoustic space, it's all, it's such a dominant image, but now we're talking about this from 65 and realized in the 70s of this the fragmentation of the sphere.
Yeah, we talked about this a few years ago when we were going over the Dew Line and his map for the 70s, and that's where you got what I was pointing out there, very complex 10 points he was making. I forget what that poster was called, but that was really influential on your perception of the thesis and the later McLuhan. And another statement made back then, remember we were talking about, he was saying that the 70s would be no media ecology required.
Yeah.
Remember that? Remember
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
And that's why he let, you know, Neil Postman run with it. He also says in Take Today that prophetic awareness, artistic visionary awareness, you know, the most advanced super awareness was obsolete. He says that right in Take Today.
Yeah, and this is why I'm trying to raise Beckett, because in a sense, wasn't Beckett he was the secretary to James Joyce.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so Beckett, okay, you've got Beckett like exposed to this incredible mind who created the most incredible novel of the 20th century, turned around and just wrecked it all with Finnegan's Wake, with this most, you know, the great white elephant of modernism. And then what does Beckett do? He goes on to be an artist of sorts, but he's actually got to grapple in Joyce's shadow, and he comes back to a very simple, blunt way of speaking.
Yeah, you know, I think McLuhan says Ionesco, one of those playwrights, just used dictionaries to get words.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and Beckett is like that. It's like, you know, caveman grunting. He's not trying to make florid Tennessee Williams plays or, you know, lococentric beauty. He's actually showing people as wooden objects and obsolesce. Sitting on the sidelines, you could make a case that Beck is showing the obsolete chemical body.
Yeah,
you know, sitting in a bag and grunting.
Yeah, so in a certain sense, McLuhan, I think, is an alternate trajectory to. I mean, insofar as he's doing applied Joyce, and he takes it further and transforms it. But in a sense, he parallels Beckett.
Yeah, he is, and see, this is where Marshall's a playwright, and he's up on what's going on in the arts and commenting on all the new stuff. I mean, he's what people call a trendy or a news junkie nowadays. He is showing that Beckett, like Burroughs, is merely reacting and not acting. Marshall is acting as a playwright because his plays would have both the effects and the causes. Beckett and all these guys are just showing effects and can't be do an interview and explain why the context are doing it. Beckett hid from the world. I remember hearing he's interviewed in the 80s and he's like hardly lets anybody in his home. They become claustrophobic or agoraphobic. Marshall's still engaged in all the obsolete scenarios and was available to explain Beckett, to give a context. And that's what we miss. We don't get Beckett and them having the guts to listen to what McLuhan was saying, that McLuhan was commenting on them, and they don't comment back. They've lost themselves, don't even know that he's commenting on them. See? No one showed up to fight McLuhan.
No, I mean that's a profound difference, is that, I guess, that levity that McLuhan had in relation to the grandiose sense of burden that Beckett labored under.
Yeah, he puts down all the existential dark people. He actually had figured out how to have a good time. He's a prophet for the subgenius church of Slack. You see those conversations with Tom Wolfe, which I think you saw in Ottawa. He's sitting in his backyard. He's looking really great. And he's just casually making these great statements, casual toss-off stuff, and just blowing Tom Wolfe's mind.
Just destroyed Tom Wolfe.
Yeah, and very just casually basking in the sun. Like remember when Wolfe says, you know, it's amazing. The things you told me back in 67 have all come true. And Marcy says, well, I'm always careful to predict what's already happened. You remember that? Beautiful interview. Just the way McLuhan, he's totally slackmaster, just sitting there indifferent to the whole 60s almost. He's living in the present.
And Tom Wolfe's trying to hoik up his best literary illusions, his knowledge of the South and all this other stuff.
Yeah, and he's slow and he's stumbling. He's not eloquent like Marshall. And that is one of the finest video images of McLuhan. He's really handsome. And he's got that his summer shirt on. When I would go by the coach house, he'd have that.
Oh, he's got a Hawaiian shirt, Bob, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a Hawaiian shirt, a colorful thing. Mary and I have talked about it. He wore that for years, you know. And I remember being there at the coach house and him having it on. But he's actually basking in the glow that he's the Muhammad Ali. He's whooped everybody and he knows it. On the level of artistic egos competing, right? But he is not limited to that. The next day, he's back at the office, you know, looking at what's going on and willing to help, willing to offer pattern recognition to whoever showed up. You know what I mean?
Totally.
So we're pointing out the victory lap of McLuhan in the 70s.
Yeah. I think we need to register. We're doing a terrible job of actually reading Inscriptorium today, but like we've done a nice archaeology of the later McLuhan of the 70s.
Well, how are we doing? What do you mean terrible job of reading?
Well, I mean, we're not exactly addressing these script issues in history. I think we've...
Yes, we are. No, here is Andrew still trying to figure out whether Marshall was a great writer or not. Because he's maybe under the influence of Eric, or just he's still too young to recognize. He's trying to justify McLuhan as a great writer and go back to literary criticism. He's missing the whole point that it's not necessary to prove McLuhan was a great writer. He was a great writer when writing was still viable, but that's not the issue in the 70s.
Okay, so who is what's Andrew McLuhan's communication theory? Well, who's the invisible enemy that Andrew McLuhan's pushing against?
Those that don't appreciate his father. And his father's a POB. So he's celebrating Eric's ability to extrapolate and explain the POB part of Marshall McLuhan.
Yeah, okay. That's fair.
Okay. Yeah, so he says, it's just fantastic. He's saying, here's Marshall just saying, I mean, these are, Wimsatt is an important person at Yale. Fry's important.
He's a heavy hitter.
Yeah, and McLuhan said these jokers, these yokels, are having nothing to say. They can't even pretend to know. They don't even pretend to know and how to say something interesting to the British invasion.
He's sitting there waiting for them to talk about Lady Gaga or something like this. And
that's right. They were awed by Empson like rustics. And then he says, Wimsatt has attacked Fry in print as I have. And he puts attacked in quotes, but they were unable to rally any social grace. See, that means to infiltrate and blindside Empson with new patterns, and Empson would be shocked by it.
Yeah, it's also a nice counterpoint to rallying, pent-up Protestant moral fury.
Yeah, so McLuhan is not advocating that, is he?
No, but he's almost pitching, because you know how he talks about Lewis's failure was the, is he didn't know how to harness that pent-up moral fury and rage. And so here he's saying, unable to rally any social grace, almost an alternative mode of
Yeah, that's a good point. That you're citing the 1959 lecture to the Catholic priests.
And
that's in The Medium and the Light. So back in the 40s, you had to rally in the 30s, rally Protestant outrage. You wouldn't do that in the politically correct 70s. And social grace is done in a new way. You actually provide a sneaky end environment to Empson through what you converse, through pleasant conversation. Right? It, what appears to be phatic, Marshall would make Manipian phatic.
Yeah.
And Wimsatt, he's saying Wimsatt won't even confront Fry. they're cowards. They've attacked each other in print, or Wimsatt attacked Fry, and they don't even make it interesting. They don't even have a fake argument, a scuffle right in front of Empson to distract Empson. That's so McClellan could just pummel Empson if Wimsatt and Fry created a distraction by arguing about their issues right in front of Empson. So Wimsatt has attacked Fry, but they were unable to rally any social grade. They were, that means, unable to verbally attack each other in a pleasant way, right, when they're in the same room. They wouldn't take each other on.
Yeah, there's no play, there's no game.
Yeah.
It's terribly serious.
That's right. I'm just hearing an echo. Empson spoke of his essays as, quote, occasional raids on English lit. Now look at that. That's what McLuhan did from the 40s. He was raiding the conventional wisdom about English literature. You see? So Marshall's talking about himself again. He did occasional raids on English lit. Mrs. Empson is a refreshingly open and boisterous gal socially. Very plain but vivacious. Both urged us to visit them in London. So he's pointing out, what is he saying here? It's the winning over and becoming friends with this enemy, this goof, Empson. You know what I mean? This get invited, instead of being respectful, intrigue Empson that he'd like to have you over because he knows you have something different to say than the silent possum role of Wimsatt and Fry. They're not even interesting to Empson. But McLuhan is, because we don't know what McLuhan said. I'm sure he... yeah, that's interesting. What did he remain respectful and didn't say much? Just like you would see him on TV with Norm Mailer and Malcolm Muggeridge. McLuhan wouldn't say much. Sometimes. So we don't know what he did, but he is writing this so that it can be known later. He's pointing out what he thinks of Fry and Wimsatt, because he knows it'll be found someday. Right? He's planting it.
Yep.
Okay, both urges to visit them in London. And then Andrew ends saying, thanks for reading. I don't think we're going to go to the next one. I think we're winding up here. How many minutes have we been going?
No, let's call this one a wrap. I don't know whether we're shorter or longer. I don't have a sense of time on this one, Bob. I'm sure it'll be one or the other.
Yeah, no, we actually... this evoked the 70s McLuhan, because you see the revolution in the McLuhan revival of the 90s, and people had decided to reread McLuhan in the 90s because of Wired magazine. They then found that he was a good writer, or they found the literary criticism, and so that's the Android meme replay of McLuhan spotlighting. But Andrew is working, Andrew McLuhan is wrestling with a 90s issue about McLuhan, missing the 70s McLuhan, which is anticipating the 90s McLuhan. The 70s McLuhan is anticipating the Madison Avenue. I talk about the icon of McLuhan that most people have is the Madison Avenue icon. But McLuhan was battling the Wired magazine icon of himself that would be retrieved in the 90s. See, a lot of people had a renewed appreciation of McLuhan's literary abilities because they were older. The baby boomers were older, and as McLuhan said, they discovered books. They had time to read McLuhan. That's what you see in a lot of the books in the 90s on McLuhan, like Glenn Mott and that woman who wrote about the Frankfurt School part. All these books, are appreciating, even Jenny March or so, they're appreciating what McLuhan was saying in the speech's archetype point. They don't get the manipulative black hole McLuhan that Scott Taylor's trying to get at.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you've got the rise of that literary cultural studies, interpretive criticism, Foucault, Jameson, Kittler, Haraway, Barth, Verrillo, Deleuze and Guattari, all these people who are sort of emergent of that literary environment. And in the 90s, McLuhan's placed in relation, back in relation to them.
Yeah, that he actually, if you actually, see, nobody read McLuhan. They didn't have time in the 70s, yep. in the 60s, 70s. Now they have time in the 90s to appreciate what he wrote, but they're still, you know, improving the image of McLuhan as a writer and thinker. They're not getting the simulation that McLuhan was involved in. Croker gets that. See, Croker critiques McLuhan, misses the 70s McLuhan, but at least he sees that the books of McLuhan are as important as McLuhan's engagement with the incipient android meme.
Yeah, well, Croker's really different, I guess, because in the 80s, he's one of the first, he is the first imprint to say that McLuhan did not deal with essentially that situation represented by the rise of the personal computer.
You're saying Croker says that McLuhan did not deal with it?
I think he draws the line and he says McLuhan's great for dealing with analog, but yes. McLuhan does not deal with digital. I mean, there's two other people that say the same. This guy, Moorthrop.
Stuart Moorthrop. Yeah.
And Lanham also says the same thing. I don't think they actually have the subtlety and the nuances that Croker has, but they
make the same mistake as Croker. See, Croker misses the Finneganese. This was Don Thiel's criticism.
Yep.
He doesn't get the Finneganese of McLuhan, and the prefiguring of cyberspace and the way we're talking about McLuhan. Croker doesn't get, but Scott Taylor does. See, Scott Taylor's the missing archivist of that period that proves that McLuhan did get the digital effects, the fragmentation that was happening, and actually was acting it out. It may not have been completely conscious, but he was responding to the black hole void in the 70s. I've seen a couple of his lectures. TV on Terror is very good. I assume they're still there. They would tape McLuhan speaking at obscure conferences, and McLuhan would walk out. You know, 1974, he'd walk out real casual with his hair stuck up. I think there's a few glimpses of that in Stephanie McLuhan's documentary. You see McLuhan speaking at the University of Florida, and he's just casual. He's so casual, he's saying very little, but what he says is weighty, and he's talking about how rock is wiping out the environment. And he talks about instant replay, tells a few jokes, and then a few tetrads. It's very lazy. He's into the hedonistic slack off that the 70s are before AIDS comes in. He's miming he's on vacation in the 70s.
Yeah.
See, the abundance of the 60s, you know, spills into the 70s, and you have much actualization of the dreams of the 60s and the 70s, and, you know, ending up in punk rock and Studio 54. And McLuhan's traveling around the world, going to Hawaii, having himself pictured in front of merry-go-rounds. That's all part of he talks about it in his dialogue with John and Yoko in December 69. You can look that up. And he says you are a product of Britain who in the 50s and 60s reached a period of contentment post-empire. That contentment he's seeing anticipated in Britain is what he's seeing all around him. It's the sunset of the West, and he says the ground is China. So the lack of POB production by McLuhan is very revealing if you see it the way I'm talking about it, the way we're talking about it with the help of Scott Taylor.
Yep. I just had one thing, though, with Croker is I think quite an interesting has happened in that respect is McLuhan didn't, like, throughout the 90s, McLuhan was seen as being less relevant in the age of the personal computer. But interesting, that's happening now. Like,
Wait a minute. You're saying in the 90s he was... They missed the digital McLuhan.
Yeah, yeah. And they were saying McLuhan is not relevant because, if say, for example, in the electronic age, the age of implosion, McLuhan's talking about a single computer, or what Deschardin calls the noosphere. But the interesting thing is, after the 90s, I mean, where we're at now, the network of networks, you know, the universal platform for all computing, you know, that we call the cloud, is one computer. The network is the computer. So in a certain sense, McLuhan's pronouncements about computers in the 60s appear now more relevant today than they were in the 90s.
Yeah, via the rhizome effect of Finnegan's Wake. And that's why Thiel filled in that gap. He's saying what you're saying, that McLuhan is relevant in the digital. And Croker misses the Finneganese. Croker does see the Leviathan nature of the digital Android meme phase, where it's a post-communication, post-information, data-trash world. Definitely McLuhan saw that.
Yep.
And then you talk about the implosion in cloud computing. Yeah, I think you can get to, you can bring McLuhan into that through Finnegan's Wake. And Croker doesn't see that. No, neither does Baudrillard. None of them.
But there's a short little window where McLuhan did appear less relevant. And then all of a sudden that window closed up again.
Because they did not see the interviews he did in Bruce Power's book. They did not see him talking about the retrieval of private space by the computer. They did not know.
Left hemisphere shift.
Yeah, they didn't know the retrieval of simulated virtual left hemisphere by the private computer. He says that in those interviews in Etc. magazine and are featured in – they're done by Bruce Powers. Croker is making an assessment in the early 80s before Powers' book comes out. But I had access to – I was reading Etc. back then and saw them when they happened in 78, 79. And I recognize where Powers got it when he posted, when he published a book in 89. So you knew, I was probably one of the few people in the world that knew that he was onto the computer as it, once it unfolded in the mid 80s. You know, once we started to see it, I said, wow, look at what McLuhan, he's predicting this. Back in, who was reading, who was looking up obscure journals and finding what McLuhan was saying in 78, 79? Only me, as far as I know. So that allowed me to balance off Croker. You know, I was talking with Scott Taylor about it. It's Croker, Dobbs, Scott Taylor, and Sherry Turkle. Okay, take that tetrad, those four approaches to the Android meme. Dobbs, with the Finneganese, and this is what Don Thiel recognized in me, Dobbs has the advantage with this knowing the obscure interviews and the Finneganese, because remember, Finney's Wake takes place in one room, one little cloud. It's HCE and his wife in bed.
Right? Yeah, and the other five family members, three family members, or two and a half family members, depending on how you categorize it, doing some other stuff.
Or dead. They never happened. They could be a dream of Aunt Olivia. The point is, it's two people asleep, but they're not. Most people take it as a dream, but no, it's multimedia, virtual. It's the Matrix. This is what Don Thiel saw. Joyce may not have consciously thought that, but you can read the Wake as the two people, modern, you know, 22nd century couple in their Matrix tubes, fantasizing they're having a family life.
Yeah.
And you know, you've got the phrase Emailia right there in Finnegan's Wake. Emailia. Emailia. World of email. So Eric emphasizes the analog meaning of the thunders. He misses what and you read Don Thiel's analysis of passages of Finnegan's Wake. They're very fine-tuned to syllable shifts. I haven't seen Eric do that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, I guess it touches on a theme that we touched on in the last session with regard to the what I called the intercerebellar texting, which is probably more accurately inter phonemic texting, that yeah. splitting of time, that if there is a conversation going on between every single letter, it shatters time and in its totality.
And Don sees that. He can take, you know, eye-ear decoding, and he can find whole paragraphs in about 6 words and break it down to the debate of the letters.
Yeah, having split the atom, it just explodes out into, like, decimated, turns everything to dust that you can pick to pieces. That's, in the infinite particle.
Yeah, like, Don Thiel's is Zappa, Finnegan's Analysis, because Zappa was making music out of digital dust, he called it.
Digital dust. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And Eric, he gets the analog history of media in the Thunders, but he doesn't get the find the collapse. He doesn't get the dialogue of the letters and spaces that Thiel does in his books, The Joyce Era and James Joyce's Technopoetics. It's fantastic the way he reads a paragraph or two of Finneganese, very refined or very something, very, very microscopic.
Yeah, I don't know whether Eric doesn't, or whether it's Eric doesn't have the audience, or he's chosen the wrong audience, because Eric's mind's neat. It works in exciting ways in some respects. He does some interesting things, but it seems like he's chosen the dumb audience to talk to.
Yeah, he's talking to the analog media zone. Yeah, the analog media galaxy. He doesn't get into the digital.
Like, you see him in the 60s, and he's early 70s. Eric McLuhan's appearing on television. He's this young, he's a good-looking guy, talking like he can talk his father's work, you know, back, front, sideways, left, right. And he's talking about the Egyptians and pyramids and everything that was new, fresh, and exciting about the culture of his day. And somewhere along the way, that fell off.
Yeah, that he didn't know how to handle the Android meme phase.
I don't know. Like, I'm not going to say either way whether he didn't know how to handle it. Or whether
wait a minute. What fell off then? What are you saying?
It's hard to say. I mean, life has many different circumstances and ways of shaping itself that are beyond an individual's control.
When Don Thiel says that Marshall McLuhan was a disservice in simplifying and reducing the beauty of Finnegan's Wake, That is something that's also a criticism of Eric. But then you take that point, and Don is only 50% right. And Don is emphasizing the logocentric or verbal part of Finnegan's Wake and missing the vast media landscapes. Or Eric sees the vast media landscapes that Don may miss. So they're both incomplete. You have to put both together, Eric and Thiel, and move past that. I don't know, what do you call the place past it?
What you're trying to offer, Bob?
Yeah, I think I do that. I think I succeed in that.
Yeah, no, let's keep it humble, eh? And,
yeah, keep it humble.
Yeah.
So let's end on a humble note. Anyways, we invite Eric to engage in our discussion. That's the point. Join in, Eric.
Yeah, or anybody. Yeah, anybody to engage, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, it's almost like he says, Fry and Wimsatt will not engage Empson. I'm saying that Eric is being like Fry and Wimsatt, not engaging Dobbs, Croker, Taylor, and Crystal, and Sherry Turkle.
Yeah, we've got a. There's a whole lot of people that are unwilling to actually converse, that are actually too scared to go to reveal their ignorance
and then explore it, make new discoveries out of the ignorance. I'm just ready to explore or to find patterns that are evoked by what you say.
Yeah, so ultimately, people propping up dialogue as a conceptual virtue, yet not stepping up in the flesh.
Yeah, not dialogue. McLuhan goes on the talk shows. You see it with the Tom, whoever that guy is, Tom Snyder. where McLuhan's sitting in a theater and talking to Snyder beside him, and McLuhan's looking up the side, very sly, and making these incredible explanations about why people try to follow him and don't recognize the discontinuity of speech and what he's saying. He's very casual. That confident McLuhan is, you can see it in those interviews. You see him playing off and satirizing the talk show kings. And okay, what I'm saying is that he's willing to engage with them, with the social graces. I mean, he just talks casually to Tom Snyder, and Snyder is going, "What? You're blowing my mind. I can't believe what you're saying." You know what I mean? And Marshall is sitting there with a casual sneer, just saying off a couple of empty lines. You know, his weakest ammunition. Yet it's just too much for Tom Snyder. Have you seen that interview?
Yeah, I think I have, but I think it was a long time ago.
Yeah, where he says, "Why do people have trouble following what you're saying, Marshall or Mr. McLuhan?" Marshall says, "Well, they try to connect what I said there with what I'm saying now." In other words, Marshall saying, "I talk like Finnegan's Wake, scattered syllables. It's hard to follow if you're trying to connect one syllable with the previous syllable." That's actually what he's saying to Snyder. Everybody knows that you're supposed to follow along what someone's saying. And he's saying, "How come people can't follow you?" And Marshall says, "Well, they try to connect what I say with what I just said."
Yeah, I mean, this is on the cusp of the period where speech is so wildly obsolete by these days. You know,
yeah, he's writing in the late 60s.
So he's fronting up and he's actually using words. That's radical. You know
what? Yeah, that's what?
That's radical.
What is?
Just turning up and speaking in a way that makes sense face to face.
Actually, that's your right. He's showing up, engaging in any environment with a casual confidence. He's just exuding confidence. He's being a cool image. That's what people notice now when they see footage of him arguing with Norman Mailer. They're struck. I mean, a couple people said this, Americans. They said, "Look at Mailer's an idiot, all heated up. And McLuhan's like, they're totally cool, not bothered by anything." The younger generations appreciate that because they've had to deal with all kinds of slings and arrows of information shock that they're naturally detached and cool.
Yeah. It's what's the golden rule? It's to say nothing.
Yeah, and they're kind of noticing McLuhan's really good at that.
Cool. Well, I think that's a wrap, Bob. I think that's we've at least hopefully opened up some interesting terrain that some people might develop themselves and join our conversation.
Oh, we have, Andrew, we have. It's never been heard before.
Okay, well, thanks, Bob. I'll press stop now, and hopefully we can continue talking briefly afterwards.
Okay, Andrew.